Welcome into a Saturday morning edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. We are talking a thrilling Nets victory over the Knicks. Josh has already both egged and TP'd my apartment, which is extremely impressive because I live on a double-digit floor. But he did it. He got me. The Nets beat the Knicks. We'll talk about it next on Locked On Nets.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
You are Locked On Nets. I am your host, Gavin Shaw. After 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns, I moved back to my native New York to host this Nets micropod, and I am joined by the GOAT, the depressed Nets fan who wasn't so depressed last night, Josh Bass, and we're talking a 107-105 Nets victory over the New York Knicks.
Gavin, what a night it was. These Nets-Knicks games mean so much more to me just because I live with two Knicks fans, and they will rub it in my face any chance they get that the Nets are a completely inferior franchise and no one cares about them, and why do I do this podcast? So it's nice to have the moral high ground over them for at least one night.
I will say it's a slight indictment how competitive this game was. I thought Brooklyn had a chance to really pull away early. In the first quarter, they looked kind of dominant, and it was very similar to the second preseason game between the two teams where the Knicks just kind of fought and clawed their way back. And I'll say this, I like the way David Fizdale gets his team to play, but all in all, you have to take it, I think, if you're a Nets fan, given the way the first game went, given the way so many close games went last season. And it's really encouraging. You have a guy in Caris LeVert you can seemingly trust down the stretch to get you a good shot in this kind of situation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go too far. LeVert played amazingly, had that great moment at the end where he was able to get the tough bucket. But let's not forget that the night before, or the two nights before against Detroit, he did come up short in the clutch. I think this is a great sign for his development that he was able to lead the Nets to that win. But I don't want to go too far and say, now he's going to be the go-to guy all the time. We know he's someone that's always going to come through. But again, this is a great sign for the Nets. And it's a win's a win, especially when you're missing key guys like Damari Carroll, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, also Shabazz Napier, Travion Graham went down in the middle of the game. A win is a win, and you have to take it, and it's a good sign moving forward.
Yeah, I will just say in a macro sense, this is, at least for me, like pretty exciting for the Knicks-Nets rivalries. We were doing that podcast series over the summer with James Marceda of Locked On Knicks, and at this point, like I think the players and coaches, actually, I can't remember if they said a pregame or postgame, but they're right. Like, I mean, right now, like, nobody gives a crap. Like, I think it might have been Fizdale who said, like, one of the teams, like, has to make the playoffs before this is considered a real rivalry, and he's right to a degree, but it's nice that both these teams have a little bit of hope. Like, for the Knicks, you saw, obviously, Tim Hardaway, who's maybe not an essential part of their future. He got 29 points in this one. More importantly, Kevin Knox, a really efficient 17 in 29 minutes, and the Knicks just look young, energetic, and they play in a really just encouraging, I guess, like New York values way, like constantly hustling, constantly making little plays. And then the Nets, like they really did have like sequences of brilliance in this game and how they like to play. Like I thought the passing in the first quarter was just outstanding. And then their young guns, Jared Allen and Caris LeVert, two excellent games to start the season for both of them. Jared Allen, back-to-back games with four blocks. LeVert, back-to-back games where he nearly sets a career high, both super efficient. I just like the fact that there are really encouraging signs for both New York teams and that this could be a battle for 5-10 years going forward if you can really trust management on both sides.
Yeah, but I do have to give Fizdale credit because he's doing a good job with this Knicks team, especially when you look at their roster right now. I mean, they're playing Vonleh, Ron Baker,
Bakur,
Thomas, significant minutes, right? Yeah, Ron Bakur. And I thought Frank actually played really well. He had a couple of nice pull-up jumpers and showed confidence in doing so, which he wouldn't have done last year. On the Nets side, I think the big takeaway is LeVert being able to put together two really great games back-to-back because we always have known he's had that potential. He's had moments, whether it be a half, a quarter, where he really shined. But the next game, he would come out and shoot 3 of 13 from the field with 6 turnovers. And being able to set his career high last night and then break it again tonight, or maybe
tie. He's one point less. I think it was 29.
Right. Two really great games, efficient from the field, a couple turnover problems here and there, but being able to show that he can be the lead option on a team, obviously early stages, but I think that's a great sign for his development. The one thing I would say is a cause for concern for the Nets is that I think we saw this problem last year where first quarter, the offense is humming, ball's moving, everything looks great. And then the next three quarters, it just shuts down. We saw that against Detroit, saw that again here, where the Nets had 10-point leads in the first half and then gradually just slipped away in the third quarter. Both those teams were able to take the lead. And kudos to the Nets for fighting back here and getting the win. But, you know, especially when you start playing more high-quality teams in the East and also the gauntlet throughout the West, that's not going to happen. When those Nets give up the leads, then the deficit's going to balloon to 10 or 15. And that's a struggle. And you're not going to be able to come back from that. The Nets just don't have the talent to do so.
Yeah, I wonder what you would pin that on, because to me, I can't really quite discern if it's an energy issue or if it's teams catching on, because the Nets, it's interesting, because I was watching, I watched the Suns' first game under new coach Igor Kokoshkov, and I was just thinking like how brilliant the passing was, and it was like the system of like elaborate back screens and like bigs running offense from the top of the key, and I think the Nets like run maybe like a slightly more simplistic version of that, but the Nets like in the first quarter, it actually looked very similar to what the Suns were doing, what the Jazz have seemingly put together offensively, where it was just this brilliant combination of really intuitive passing and off-ball movement. There were these two sequences that, as a passing lover, just, wow, really, really got me going. There was the one where, like, Jared Dudley just, like, slipped this beautiful little pocket pass into LeVert on the cut, and then LeVert just dropped it off to Allen for a dunk. And then there was another one where D'Lo, like, this is, like, again, just, like, a small example of, like, the genius he can be at times as a ball mover. He throws that pass to the corner to Joe Harris. That's just, like, it looks like, on the surface, it's like, all right, like, what is this accomplished? Like, you're just hitting Harris in the corner. But it was just, like, the intuitiveness that, oh, his defender isn't looking. I can fit into this corner. It's the type of pass, like, a great NFL quarterback makes, and D'Lo is just throwing it with ease, and then Harris just slings it inside to, I believe, Allen, if I remember correctly, for a dunk, or it might have been someone else on the last shot. But just those two sequences, like, to me, like, summed up what this Nets offense can be when you put a lot of guys who are really, really smart passers. And I think it's interesting that they, again, like, I think Dudley's most likely just starting, because Hollis, Jefferson, and Carroll remain out, but putting Dudley out there and Harris out there, and we should get into it a little bit on whether Harris is the permanent starter over Crabb or not, but just putting those two out there with Russell, LeVert, and Allen, you have four really, really good passers out there at once. And to me, that's kind of the ceiling of this Nets team offensively. You can question if it's worth having Dudley out there on the other end, but just aesthetically, I love watching them like that, and I think it helped them get off to a really good start.
Yeah, but I don't even know how D'Lo saw that path, so kudos to him, because that was just brilliant. I think the one thing that we can maybe look at and why the Nets offense does slow down after the first quarter is just a stamina issue, because the guards on the Nets are doing so much work to get open and really create the offense. I mean, guys like Dinwiddie, Russell, LeVert, even Crabb and Harris are just running around so much and really having to break down the defense on each possession, because they don't really have the forwards and big men to create their own looks. So it's just putting a lot of strain on them. That might change a bit when Rondae Hollis-Jefferson comes back, because he is the one four-man on the team that can really create his own shot. We saw last year how good he is facing up from 15 feet and being able to either hit that mid-range shot or drive to the basket and get fouled and finish through contact. So he can really help out and put some give the guards some plays off, and maybe they're going to be a bit fresher when it comes to the second half.
Yeah, no, it's certainly exciting, and it does seem like he's close to coming back. Instead of being out with an injury, he was out due to the birth of what I believe was his first child. So shout out to Rondae Hollis-Jefferson.
Mazel tov.
With that, yeah, I'm sure he'd love to hear that. With that, we will take our first break, come back, continue breaking down this Nets game, and then maybe get a little bit into Nets Pacers tonight. That next on Locked On Nets. Yeah, Josh, I want to continue along the conversation we were just having, because it is interesting to me, like, why this Nets offense breaks down. And I'm wondering, like, if, again, like, I don't want to pin everything on a guy like D'Lo, but you mentioned, like, the sheer amount of work these guards have to do to get open. Like, D'Lo, it just seems, like, exhausting the way he plays, because he doesn't have that natural burst that both Dinwiddie and LeVert possess, and because of that, it seems like he has to work so, so hard to generate shots. It's all these pump fakes and starting and stopping and herky-jerkiness. And I'm wondering if he just tires out, because obviously he really came alive in the fourth quarter, but he had a pretty off game for the second time in a row.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. He's out of rhythm, and maybe it's because last year he was unquestionably the guy every time he was on the court. and now Dinwiddie's emerged last year as a key cog. LeVert obviously has taken a mini leap and is a really good player now. So I think he's still trying to figure out where his role is on the team and if he should be spotting up more, if he's going to be the lead ball handler. And again, he still struggles with breaking down the defense, as you mentioned. He just doesn't have the burst, and he holds the ball a lot. So he's losing his advantage when he does that. So he needs to start going quickly. Enough with the jab steps, pump fakes. And we saw even last night, the game was tied at the time. He was bringing the ball down with 35 seconds. I forget who was guarding him, whether it was Trey Burke or Nil Aquina, but they were pressuring the ball a lot.
Yeah, it's Trey Burke.
Yeah, Trey Burke. And he just was doing a crab dribble from almost the half court line and nearly lost the ball. And or he did lose the ball. It almost went out on him. That was a very close call. If the refs had initially said that it was off D'Lo, then I don't think there was enough evidence to overturn that. So that would have been a huge blow. And he just needs to get better with the ball in his hands. I mean, I think in the open court, with his passing vision, he can be a really great player, but he needs more consistency in the half court when the game does slow down, because he's struggling right now.
Yeah, and that was with Alan Crabb screaming from the sideline, "Don't dribble like me," and he wouldn't listen to him. All right, I guess somewhat natural follow up on that, and maybe before I even get into this, I should say give D'Lo some credit. He made a few really big shots / passes in the fourth quarter. Like he really stepped up after getting benched against the Pistons.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what you think about maybe starting Dinwiddie over him at some point this season. I know Dinwiddie didn't really have a great game. Like, if anything, Russell was maybe a little better. Like, Dinwiddie was just 4 of 12, 2 for 6 from three. But I will say, like, he's just clearly, like, more explosive. And just watching both of them, like, especially, like, now that Dinwiddie seems like he's at a level of conditioning and just physical aptitude that he wasn't at any point last season, I just intuitively tend to think Dinwiddie's the better player. And I'm wondering, because last season, obviously, when they were both healthy, it was always Russell and Crabb, and it seems like they might have moved in the direction of Harris. I wonder if Atkinson is willing to make another lineup change and go with Dinwiddie, and clearly they have so much more invested in Russell than Dinwiddie, but I just think that dynamic is very fascinating, and I'm wondering if that shifts at any point.
Yeah, I think as of now, especially with Napier out, it makes sense to have Dinwiddie with the second unit, because he's a lot better at breaking down his man, and we saw in the Pistons game, he was able to just get a lot of easy layups to the basket, even though he didn't have a lot of talent around him. He was really the only guy in those bench units that could create his own shot. And I think if you have Russell out there instead of Dinwiddie, the offense is really going to bog down even more, just because Russell, he's very inconsistent in terms of being able to score one-on-one. So I like the way they have it right now with Russell and LeVert in the starting lineup, Dinwiddie getting kind of leading most of the bench units. And maybe when it, later on in the season, if Napier's looking good, it makes sense to pair Napier and D'Lo more and then have Dinwiddie and LeVert and try that out. But I think let's see what happens, at least for give it a 10 or 15 game sample size before making any other changes.
All right. No, I think that's a great answer. I totally agree with you. All right. Before we get into Nets Pacers tomorrow, let's just roll through the lineup and maybe give some quick thoughts on some other guys. Joe Harris, who did not shoot exceptionally well the first game, didn't shoot really well in the preseason. He had himself a nice night, 3 of 4 from three. I love the form on his jump shot. I thought it was like a little flat in the preseason, but he's really able to get some good arc on it in this game and just hit a lot of them on the run. He was like a little quiet in the second half, but I'm assuming you're with me on this. And I thought Alan Crabb actually looked decent when he first came in, didn't end up having a very good shooting night. I think he might have missed like 4 of his last 5 shots or something.
I think he missed his last 5.
Maybe.
He started 2 of 2.
Right, okay. Go ahead.
I think on Joe Harris, yeah, he hit a couple of threes that were J.J. Redick, like just completely on the move, like really tough looks.
Yeah.
Crabb, he got good looks. I mean, it might be a rust just because those are shots that he can hit and he should hit, because that's really the only value he provides. So this Nets team had a couple plays where he got lost off the ball, but obviously coming back from injury, he didn't play a lot in the preseason because he got hurt and with that ankle sprain. So I think you got to give him a couple games at least to let him get back in the rhythm.
Yeah, Dudley, we largely went over his contributions already. I never quite know what to make of him because, again, like physically, he does like just constantly look washed and not like someone who should necessarily be in the NBA. But he does make these really smart plays. He hit a gigantic three with 5 minutes left in this one that, I mean, with the final score, ended up proving somewhat essential to the Nets winning. So nice effort for him. Jared Allen, I thought, again, really, really good. 15 points, 11 boards. four blocks, played 34 minutes, which I'm wondering how much that's going to be the norm for him. And
I'm surprised he played that much because I thought Ed Davis was also really good. I mean, Allen was great, but I think the minute split should be a bit more even. I think Jared Allen was really good. Obviously, his finishing inside was awesome, but he did get bullied a lot by Kanter.
Yeah.
Can't just a note on Kanter, he's gotten so much better in the last few years. He's just devastating on offense, and he's a bit annoying, I know, to a lot of fans in the league, but I kind of love his antics. I think he's just such a troll, and he fits in well with the New York culture.
I think you and Kanter have similar personalities too, a little bit. You're both like, you have a little playful troll in you, but you're ultimately effective because of it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyways, I wonder why people keep like going at Jared Allen. Like, I remember like when Knox just tried to like just lay it in over him at the end of the game. Like, what are you thinking? You saw what happened to Blake Griffin. Like, just give the guy a break. Like, you're just feeding the beast at that point with Jared Allen. The one negative I will say on Allen is with about 30 seconds left in the game, Nets had the ball up by three, really chance to all but put the game away. And LeVert made a really, I think it was LeVert, it could have been D'Lo, but they made a really brilliant play, like drawing a double team and then just throwing it into Allen, who had Trey Burke on a switch, and all he had to do was turn and lay it in, and that's essentially the game, unless there's a miracle for the Knicks. And instead, he kind of looks at the basket and then throws it out to Dinwiddie, who's wide open for three, and in another situation, you could argue that was maybe the right play, but Allen had like almost a short two, and he didn't take it.
I disagree. I think that was the right play to kick it out to Dinwiddie.
He had a layup. He had Burke on him.
There was help coming over.
But if he just went straight up, you're either dunking that or you're getting fouled.
I think it's a good habit to be able to make that kick out pass to Dinwiddie. And we see a guy like Clint Capella be able to make that pass, and that's a big sign of his development. And Dinwiddie needs to hit that three because he was wide open.
Sure. I think, there are situations where that's a smart play. And if you have a different guy on you, that's a really good pass. And, like, I get why he makes that pass. Like, I bet the Nets, like coaches, like, drive into him, like, all right, you get the ball, you're covered down low, you got to look to whip it out to the corner. Because the corner three, like, one of the most efficient shots in the game. But you'll hear this time and time again. And, like, it's something I think a lot of smart NBA people always reiterate. As valuable as the three-pointers become, if you have a relatively open layup or dunk, that is still going to be the better shot. And I think, especially in that situation, up by 3:35 seconds left, like, Allen, like, you just got to go through Trey Burke. Like, you're right under the basket. There was help coming, but it was late enough that he could have gotten a shot off there.
That's fair. Can we just talk quickly about the rebounding?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, go ahead.
Remember that one play where the Knicks got either four or five offensive rebounds in one possession?
Yeah.
Yeah, that just can't happen because I was looking at their lineup again, and it wasn't like they had a bunch of bruisers on the court. I mean, it was Kanter, who's obviously a beast. Knox, who's like a big guy, but he's not like he's huge for playing the four. And then Hardaway, Trey Burke, and Ntilikina. It's not like they were throwing the Monstars out at you. I mean, the Nets have to be more physical in boxing out. You can't let those five guys get five offensive rebounds in a possession. That was frankly embarrassing, and I had me screaming at my TV.
Yeah, and that was obviously a big issue against Detroit, and we thought Detroit was the exception rather than the rule. Now, the Knicks are like one of the few other teams in the league that plays a center that's just physically capable of just bullying Allen, and I mean, you made a valiant point that it wasn't all Kanter, like it was a lot of different guys, but I do think it's one of those things where Kanter almost has rebounding gravity, which isn't something that gets talked a lot about in the NBA, but like that's like guards like kept trying to chip him and were kind of looking at him and seeing if Allen needed help, and I think that opened up little windows for other guys to get rebounds, and it was obviously disastrous at points. And I think in a lot of ways the Knicks kind of punked the Nets in this game because talent wise like Brooklyn is really quite a bit better across the board, and the Knicks were in it just because they were tougher to a degree. All right, that'll wrap up our second segment. We will come back. I want to give a quick mention to Rodion's Kurutz when we do, and then we can maybe do a minute on Nets Pacers that next on Locked On Nets. Third and final segment on Locked On Nets, Saturday morning edition. We could be getting brunch. I could be getting ready to watch college football, but instead we are with you talking about what will likely prove to be a meaningless Knicks-Nets game, but it was legitimately a lot of fun while it was happening. Gavin Shaw, Josh Bass with you. Josh, before we finish up the player breakdowns, I want to talk about Kurutz a little bit because he did have a lot of bad like rookie moments, but I continue to be really impressed with him and just how proactive he is, how energetic he is. Like there were some clear mistakes there, but all in all, I really like how he plays and he just finds a way to make an impact. 17 minutes, 11 points, 5 boards. That's impressive for a second career game.
Yeah, I think for a second round rookie, it's great sign because he doesn't really look out of place when he's on the court. I mean, he moves well. He's decent size. So all good signs. He's being productive. Again, had that killer turnover at the end of the third quarter where he tried to do a very aggressive push and made an errant pass, which was a sign throughout most of the game. I mean, there were so many bad turnovers from Dinwiddie, from D'Lo. Even LeVert had a couple sloppy ones, and that can't happen. So that was really the big key in the game. But again, Kuritz has done pretty well through his first two games, much better than I would have ever expected when he was drafted in June.
Yeah, Kenny Atkinson used the term fearless to describe the rookie, and that's an important quality, and it's one that ultimately only matters if he's physically capable of competing, and he absolutely has proven to be just that, and that is I think that's really exciting if you're Brooklyn because you might have got a steal in him, yeah. And we don't even know what they have in Musa yet.
Do you think Musa is going to go to the D League and spend most of the year there? It just doesn't seem like he's in the plans to play a lot this year.
Well, the D League doesn't exist, so we just want to send him to Narnia or maybe the Forbidden Forest. That would be just as good. Now, yeah, probably. I think that'll happen. Especially, I mean, the Nets. Ideally, unless things go really, really wrong, they're not going to be more injured than they are now. So that seems like the way it's heading. All right. Before we wrap up, and we do need to wrap up in a minute or two. The Nets, I believe they traveled to Indiana. We're going back to Michael Grady's hometown, as was a big emphasis on the broadcast. I guess it's more of a state, but I don't know. Indiana had the Nets number last season, even though there were some thrilling games in there. They got ran by Milwaukee last night, so we're going to be facing an angry – wow, I think that was the first time I said we. That's a bad sign. they're going to be facing a pissed-off Pacers team that has a lot of talent. What do you expect out of that?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good game. Always great to see former Nets Thaddeus Young and Bojan Bogdanović in uniform. I think big key for this game is going to be keeping them off the glass. I mean, Sabonis is an excellent offensive rebounder. Miles Turner isn't too shabby as well, and it's going to be who's going to take the primary matchup on Victor Oladipo. I think Caris LeVert can do a good job on him. He has the requisite size and quickness to hang with Oladipo as well as anyone can. But again, it's about being consistent on the offensive end, keep taking care of the ball, hitting threes, because Nets haven't had – they were actually decent from three last night, but against Detroit really struggled hitting shots. And if you're not going to hit shots against this Indiana team – there's really not going to be a good chance of the Nets winning because Indiana does have a very talented roster, especially with the additions of Tyreek Evans and also Kyle O'Quinn, who I think is under the radar signing for them this year.
Yeah, I think if you want to gauge just how good LeVert is at this point, whether he's like merely the best player on the Nets or someone who could theoretically merit All-Star contention, I think this game is going to be very, very telling. There are maybe five guys in the league that present the two-way challenge Oladipo does on a night-to-night basis. If you're guarding him and being guarded by him the entire game, and LeVert coming off two career performances, now on a back-to-back, you got to immediately hit the road, go all the way to Indiana. Like, if he can have a great game against Oladipo, that's really going to tell you something. And if he doesn't, it's not something I would overreact to, because I'd say everything is kind of going against him. So there's a lot of upside for LeVert tonight against the Pacers. I'm sure we will be back either Sunday or maybe Sunday night, and you'll listen to it Monday morning to talk to you about it. Until then, enjoy your weekend. Enjoy some college football. Enjoy some Nets basketball. We'll be back with you soon.